35 minutes after the hour. Presence, we have Senator Elton, Wilton, Wilkins, Green, and Dyson. I suspect Senator Olson will be here. So I intend to continue the hearings on SB 125, also to hear SB 150, and continue on SB 10. Senator Olson has joined us. So, Dr. Mossett, are you ready?
For the record, my name is Dr. Monsager. I'm the Director of the Division of Public Health. Thank you, Chairman Dyson and members of the committee, for continuing discussion of SB 125. What I intend to do just for introduction today is to spend about 1 minute reviewing where we left off 3 weeks ago, and then review quickly some of the answers to some of the questions we'd received from members of the committee, and then introduce some amendments that have developed both out of that and out of finding some drafting errors and developing some conforming amendments, and introduce them to you. And then I'm available for questions, and we can do that in any order you want to do that, Senator Dyson.
I think your order is fine.
Okay. So just as a quick review, given the amount of legislation you all deal with, SB 125 is the bill to consolidate HSS licensing, certification, and background check functions. I gave you handouts last time. I'm not going to do that again today. And it's, remember, in context, this is a bill to bring together all of the licensing and certification activities that the department does for all the kinds of programs and facilities that are licensed or certified by the department, ranging from hospitals to assisted living homes to agencies that do hospice, etc. There were a series of questions that came out of the, well, maybe before I'll get there, I think you have in your packet a two-column, do you have a two-column thing in your packet?
I think so.
What this is one of the questions that came is, what's new and what's current law in SB 125? See if you have that or not. You don't?
Again, please.
You have one like this? Yes, Senator Wilkin has it.
Like this?
Yes. And this is really a reference document for you that highlights from the Department of Law a summary of what's new in this statute and what is current law.
Actually, this looks...
That's the other bill. Just give me a copy, Jason.
Can I pause for a moment?
It's okay. You can go ahead.
Okay. And I'm not going to propose to talk about it. I just want you to know that you have it as a reference document if you get questions or are thinking about, or if we have any questions that deal with specific parts of the Act, just so that you know you have that there. Then I'll go to this one, which is a letter we sent to Senator Dyson about a week ago, which is an answer to the questions that had come from all of you. And we collated the answers together, and I thought I would just briefly walk through some of the questions, but not all of them. We can have conversation about any of them you have questions about. We tried to address in this letter the issues of waivers and variances in the statute, what is exempt, what's not exempt, and the question about waivers. As you can see at the bottom of page one, is really waiving the application process in some cases, but keeping facilities licensed. There, what other things should we highlight? There are have been questions about why is there may language instead of shall language in terms of investigating complaints, and it has to do with the type of complaints that comes in, and that sometimes complaints can be investigated by telephone. Sometimes they are issues that can be dealt with by asking for information. You can get information back in writing. And other times a complaint is such that somebody needs to go out in person and do an investigation. And so this gives, and in regulation, then it will define the different types of experiences that would exist then. When we get to the amendments, down at the, I'll introduce a correction down at the second to the last bullet on the second page. the question was asked, why doesn't 4464060 apply? And that was a drafting error, and that'll be, is in one of the amendments to correct that. That's in the Administrative Procedures Act and for administrative hearings. I think maybe I'll pause and see if there are questions in response to this letter before we proceed onward.
All right. So I raise Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Has there been a problem with the either the complaints department, where they're not being consolidated, or with difficulties with licensing some facilities? Is that the reason that this bill is before us?
Senator Olson, through the chair, the issue is not that. It's the fact that right now we have a myriad of mixture of statutory and regulatory procedures depending upon the type of facility. For example, in current statute, assisted living homes and for-profit hospices have most of their rules defined in statute. Everything else has most rules in regulation. Nonprofit hospices have their rules defined in regulation. And then even within regulation, since they've developed over time, the different rules for appeals, the different rules for complaints are different, have been developed at different times. And so the reason for this is to put into statute a simplification effort, and then we can standardize processes. Many organizations like HOPE or ARC in Anchorage have different programs that are different types of ones that we regulate, and right now they as an administration have to keep track of different sets of rules depending upon what type of program they have. And Department of Law, the deal helps us deal with these, has to keep track, okay, well, this is this kind of program, we got to go with that set of rules, et cetera.
Mr. Chairman, if I can continue. So if I was to ask a for-profit or non-profit entity that's out there, whether it's a hospice or otherwise, you know, are your burdens going to be greater or lesser with this SB 125? What would I expect the answer to be?
Senator Olson, through the chair, I think in general you will hear they think this is a good thing. And we've, in the intervening 3 weeks since the last time this is heard, we've heard from a number of organizations. I think you have in your packet copies of letters we've gotten from different organizations. And in general, most organizations say this is a good thing. We haven't heard anybody say this is a bad thing. Now, that being said, there are, for some things or some entities, going to be an expansion of responsibilities. For example, background checks are going to be expanded to some kinds of entities that don't have to do it today.
And with that, one thing that I, coming from the private sector, one of the things that's confusing and it's hard to keep up with and is the different rules that keep changing, whether it's regulation and or statute. But I see that in some ways it impedes those entities that are out there that are obviously either barely making it or not, or are short of horsepower in one way or another, and I find that they would be going out of business. Would there be anybody that would be not offering the services a year from now based on this new statute that's going through that are giving in the healthcare delivery system now?
Senator Olson, through the chair, I'm confident that if they are a competent organization, they will continue to be in business a year from now. If they don't go out of business, if they go out of business, it's going to be for other reasons, for financial viability or something, not because of this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Doctor, would you speak to the issue that I raised with you just before the meeting started?
Senator Dyson, you asked me the question about bullet number one, and you can see the answer in front of you about abortion facilities. And your information, as we talked before we started, is that this answer isn't probably correct, in that your understanding is that organizations that perform abortions have to be licensed. I have some people checking on that right now, and I can't answer that at this moment.
Here's what the state law says. This is 18-16-010. Abortion may not be performed unless, one, the abortion is performed by a physician licensed by the state medical board, or two, this is the operative one, the abortion is performed in a hospital or a facility approved for the purpose by the Department of Health and Social Services, and it has an exception for a federal government or an agency of the federal government. So I would think that the plain reading of that is that it has to be either in a hospital or a facility that has been specifically approved for that service by your department.
The what you read there, Senator Dyson, implies the first paragraph line, though, wasn't there an or there that it could be a doctor licensed in the state?
No.
It has to, it's an and statement?
Yeah, it's, they're in series. They're separated by a semicolon.
Okay.
And,
well,
and I certainly know that anecdotally I heard, and this is three-year-old information, that because of the scarcity of physicians willing to perform abortions, the guys were flying up here from Seattle to do these services who were not licensed in the state by this. But I, there was pretty good sources, but I don't know that. But anyways, ma'am.
Senator Dyson, this is Virginia Stankus. She was quickly trying to get an answer.
On the phone, answering your question, or trying to get an answer. And again, for the record, my name is Virginia Stankus. I'm with the Division of Public Health. The first part is the issue of licensed physicians, and you're correct. Physicians are licensed not by public health or certification licensing, but by the Board of License or by the Board
right.
of Medical Examiners. The second question is in a hospital licensed by the state. The hospital does not we do not license the services that are provided in the hospital. We defer to, and if they meet the criteria in the statute or in the regulations,
yep.
they are licensed. The decisions in terms of what is performed or what services are available in those individual institutions are determined by their Board of Governors.
Yeah, no, it's not so. That's not the issue. The issue is the abortions are performed not in a hospital.
If they're not a licensed entity, and since, again, we don't license individual physicians or individual physician clinics, they are not licensed by the state.
Senator Dyson, I think that we have to go back and talk to our staff whether we license specifically for abortion. I don't think we do.
Okay.
I think we have licensed ambulatory surgical centers, but I have to go look at the form in response to your question in terms of do we require them to tell us that they're performing abortions, and I can't tell you that.
Yeah, so the law says or other facility approved for the purpose by the Department of Health and Human Health and Social Services, you know, and I don't, this is no big deal, but I've raised this a half a dozen times in the 8 years I've been here, and pretty sure it's an issue. I've never been satisfied that the health department is in compliance with state law and somebody is after it. If the former was true that doctors were flying up here who were not licensed in this state, you know, that would be investigated by who? I realize it's a licensing, not your department.
Senator Dyson, it would be investigated by the investigators of the Board of Medical Examiners if a physician is practicing medicine in the state without a license.
And I think that's a reactive function. They react if there's a complaint. They're not proactive out there investigating, although I ask them to. All right, thank you. So I don't want to be a hard nose, and because of my great regard for you, I won't be on this issue, but because we've raised this issue before on the report, at least, that abortions are happening in facilities that don't meet the law, with anybody else but you, I'd say this is over. Not only get out of here, but go get it fixed before you come back and we deal with it. But out of my respect for you, I won't. All right. Tell me again about the waiver stuff. This is next to the bottom bullet on the first page.
Chairman Dyson, I'll let Ms. Stankus try and answer that.
Again, through the chair, the issue here in terms of what we're trying to be able to set up is a process through our regulations of who and how and when. I think what we were trying to do in statute was set the framework to allow us to accommodate a 300-bed hospital or a 3-bed assisted living home in terms of what kinds of issues should and should not be applied to for a number of different issues. So, again, I think what we were putting in the law was the minimalist framework to allow the agency to go back and then work with the numbers of different programs that would be subject to licensure so that we don't inadvertently exclude or preclude particular facilities or programs from being subject to certain barrier crimes, for example. I think we'd already let you know or advised you that some issues, we may be treating adults a little bit differently than children and some of the issues. So that was an opportunity to make sure that we could accommodate those sorts of requirements.
So I assume that you would say none of the waivers, variances, or exceptions will in any way threaten health, the health of the patients, and so on. They are to make accommodations so
that's correct.
People can be doing the good things that they're doing. All right. Would you like to talk a little bit about, I think I agree with you, but why we are, the criminal background checks will include charges as well as convictions?
Chairman Dyson, this has been a subject that has been under great discussion internally, whether the bill should include the phrase charged with a crime. And the issue is that if somebody is charged with a crime, often they will leave employment, it may not get prosecuted, and it vanishes into nothinghood. In the interest of trying to get a full picture of an individual as we start evaluating them, the bill as proposed would include somebody having to tell us if they've been charged with and having us have the ability to go look and see if they've been charged with a crime. It doesn't necessarily mean that in regulation if they've been charged with that that will be a bar to employment, but it may be in some cases. But at least it gives us a fuller picture at the start of the process, and then in regulation then we can, depending upon what the charges were, can decide what's a bar, what's just a concern. And I think I'll stop there.
And who will have access to that information?
The criminal information or the civil information?
Yes.
Criminal information will be available to, what's the statute say? Should we let Stacy answer that? Is she online?
Stacy or Don Brad? Is Ms. Crayley online?
Is Stacy Crayley online?
Yes.
Could we let her from Department of Law answer that
Stacy,
question?
Stacy, are you there?
I am.
Did you hear the question, Stacy?
Yeah. For the record, my name is Stacy Crayley, and I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law. And the question, I'll just reiterate it and make sure I'm on the same track as everyone, is what sort of information and what would be available with respect to the criminal registry and the civil registry? So the criminal information is all public information, whether you're charged with a crime, with respect to adult charges anyway, different standard for juveniles, as you know. But if somebody's been charged with a crime or convicted of a crime, all of that is public record, and anybody can go to the court clerk's office and look that up regardless. So that's all public information. With respect to the civil registry, the premise is that the information would be available to the department and to individuals who want access to that information, because we need to ensure that individuals who are, let's say somebody is terminated from employment for, we'll say allegedly stealing a resident's money. But there's no charge, there was no complaint filed, so there was no criminal charge. But that's a serious issue that we would want to have put onto the civil abuse registry. The premise is, and we're still fleshing out some of these concepts, is that there would be a due process mechanism by which an individual would have their name put on that list to ensure that if there was, you know, it was a vindictive employer who fired somebody and there was no proof of wrongdoing, their name would go on that list. At this point, I think that in the vetting process, we envision that the civil registry would be a public document, but we haven't quite made that decision completely and are looking at some ideas on how to make sure that the best information is available to the state and to the entities in ensuring everybody's privacy rights and their right to not have their names put out there when it's not appropriate. So right now, I think we thought it would be a public document, but I think we've considered that maybe to not be the best case scenario. and at this point, it's still rather theoretical, but the criminal information is clearly public, and right now we're deciding what's the best case of action, or course of action to take with respect to the civil registry.
I can sure see this problematic. When somebody applies for one of these jobs and they are told that they will have to go through a criminal background check and civil, will they be informed that the results of that check will be public and on a registry?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't think the results of that check would be on the registry, but the information that we relied upon would be in a repository. And so I think as the employment process would take place, you would say, you fill out a state application, you have to say if you've ever been, convicted of a crime and what was it and that sort of thing. This would be a little more thorough because of the importance of the care that these individuals are providing to vulnerable adults and children in our state. So they would be told that they have to notify, write what they've been, if they've been charged or convicted of anything or been, terminated for employment for any reason, acknowledge that they have to have a criminal background check, which would be a fingerprint check. And then once we get this information and we start building this civil registry, they'll also be notified that this registry exists, and if there's been a wrongdoing, their name may be on that list, but we need to make sure that before their names get on that list, we're protecting everybody's rights and doing it with due process in mind.
Yeah, I appreciate the completeness of your answer, but simply, will they be told that the information from the criminal check, including charges and civil actions that they've been subject to, will be on a registry?
I believe so. Again, Mr. Chairman, I believe that they would be notified of that through the application process. The question, again, just to further clarify, is whether or not that civil registry would be a public document. And that right now we're thinking is probably not the best course of action to take.
Yeah, I let the record reflect here that certainly the intention of this legislator that must be in the application process, people that get that clear. My guess is that you'll lose some of your candidates at that exact moment, including 3/4 of my friends.
Senator Dyson, when I worked for the Indian Health Service, I had to go through a background check because of the Indian Child Welfare Act, that any of us that work with children had to go through a similar background check, and it was made a part of the employment process. I assume we'll do the same thing.
And let me add, none of the friends in this room would I think would be.
No.
All right. So, also, when you include charges, I know I was thinking particularly Senator Green and I, but we have seen folks in custody and divorce proceedings file domestic violence and child abuse, child molest charges that the cynics amongst us think are motivated more by spite or to tilt the custody property distribution rulings. How should we think about charges like that never bring convictions and might be spite or motivated when we're going to list the charges in a public registry? Stacy?
The criminal charges aren't going to be in a public registry. That information will be gathered through the public process for the criminal court system. So there won't be, and I apologize if I didn't speak clearly on this, there will be an abuse registry for civil issues, and the criminal, there won't be a corresponding criminal registry because that information is already public and accessible through the court system. But you make a very good point about the charging issue or the language about being charged with a complaint. And what we wanted to do was, as Dr. Monsanger mentioned, is get a clearer picture of an individual. And when there is a charging document, we want to be able to look at that and, if appropriate, make a decision that, if they were charged for a sexual abuse of a minor, but it never went to trial because the victim was too young. That's a bigger concern than, you know, when you look at an information and you allow somebody to explain, well, I was in the middle of a contentious divorce and my wife or my husband called the police and charged me with domestic violence and the charge was dropped because there was nothing to it. I mean, we want to be able to give people the ability to look at that and present that information, and those clearly would not be of concern to us because, they wouldn't create those barrier crimes that we're more concerned with. But that's why we want to have the ability to look at that, and when there is those types of charges, we look at it, have the individuals provide information, say, well, this really wasn't a problem, and this is why, and here's the police report, and this is why it didn't get charged. You know, it was basically a divorce issue, and there's nothing to it, and we'll look at that and take that into consideration.
Yeah, maybe I'm not listening as clearly or carefully as I should. So the criminal stuff won't be on the registry?
No, Mr. Chairman. The abuse registry is for the civil issues only because the criminal information is already accessible.
All right. And so I thought I heard you say earlier that you were making decisions about whether the civil stuff would be on there.
Well, we'll have to make decisions for the civil registry with respect to those types of instances where somebody's been terminated for a wrongful act, if you will, but there's not been any sort of adjudicatory finding that the act actually took place. So we'd have to make some sort of process available to ensure that people's names, if they were put on this abuse registry, were put on it appropriately and not because of a vindictive employer or a misunderstanding or something of that sort. So it's a complicated process, but we're trying to figure out a mechanism whereby we get a full picture of the individuals who are being employed by the facilities that we license and who care for the adults and children in our communities. And we think that this abuse registry will give us a fuller picture.
So, yeah, I'm getting more uneasy. So lots of cases, as I understand it these days, against medical professionals, there's certainly lots of accusations from my doctor provider friends about lots of spurious suits and so on, and then they argue that that it is so expensive that they will often move to a settlement that never really decides whether they're guilty or not. It is just purely a monetary thing that they duck the hassle by paying off the blackmailer. And those are their words, not mine.
Chairman Dyson, if you look on page 28 of the bill on line 5, we're not talking about the civil registry being any and all kinds of civil actions. It's limited to the applicant or the employee committed abuse, neglect, or exploitation under certain statutes. So it's limited to things that are pertinent to these kinds of facilities. I've gotten calls from a couple of directors of organizations, one an assisted living home and one a hospice organization, saying, please make sure in this statute that if employees commit fraud, that is captured here, so that if they commit Medicaid fraud, another employer doesn't find out that they've employed somebody. And so this language, I think, is important, that it's not too broad, but is broad enough to capture the kinds of civil things that are bad for people who work in these kinds of organizations.
Yeah, Senator Elton.
To kind of follow up on that thought, though, my concern is that with this new abuse registry, that it can be used by an employer to force a resignation or get a person to leave. And the hammer would be, if you don't do it, your name could end up on the abuse registry. But if, in fact, abuse happened, instead of going through a protracted personnel kind of battle, this person might decide, okay, I'm going to resign and I'll walk down the street and go to work someplace else.
Senator Elton, through the chair, I'll let Stacy think for a second how she wants to add to this answer, but we talked about that in the sense that we need to be able to capture places where people leave before they get reported to the police. And the question is how you capture that information, where can you get that from? So I would envision that our regulations would have employers being able to report to us if somebody leaves in lieu of getting reported to the police because of some abusive act they've done against an employer, that that would become information that would be available to us. Stacy, do you want to correct me if I'm wrong?
No, I don't think you're wrong. And through the chair, Senator Elton, I think that Dr. Mossager carefully crafted that response to guess what we want to do. We want to be able to encourage employers to make good decisions about bad employees and conversely report that to us so that when they do go down the street, the next employer can call up and say, well, Joe Smith just came in and applied for a position. What do you know about him? Or can I see that is his name on the registry? And we can say, well, actually, he just got fired last week for abusing a resident. And so this is going to be something that will be very beneficial to the homes and the facilities that we license. And we want to be able to encourage them to use it for their benefit as well as for the benefit of the state.
If I could follow up, and Stacy, I guess the concern that I have is that personnel actions that tend to make somebody angry can be very, very difficult. And it is not unknown for an employer. I would think it would be a stretch to assume that all employers are going to react in the manner in which you've reacted. Some may say it is easier, you know, to threaten this action to get a person to just walk away quietly. But the implied contract between the employer and the disappearing employee might be that you make it easy on us by leaving quietly, and we're not going to report you to an abuse registry.
Senator Elton, as I think about that, I'd like to be able, as this bill moves along, be able to think about that and think about, as we think about the civil registry, if it is an idea that has merit, as to how we would require employers to let us know that somebody has left in lieu of being terminated or in lieu of having to report to the police for one of these activities that would fall into here. And this is going to be really tricky territory because, as Stacy said, they haven't been adjudicated, they've had no time for an appeal, they just walk. But yet, I think vividly about a conversation I had last week with an employer in the Anchorage area who said, somebody left my employment, law decided not to prosecute because it was small Medicaid fraud, and I heard a week later they were working in one of my competitors down the street, and I don't want to have to deal with that.
I appreciate that. A good question.
Are we ready to move to amendments?
No.
No.
Okay.
Did you get a disposition paper on the bill from the ASHNA?
Yes.
And I'm sorry, have you given us a response to that?
I have some verbal comments to make in response to that.
Let her rip.
Okay. The
Maybe you can go item by item.
Item by item.
The things that Rod raises.
He points at the bottom of page 1, section 4732140, page 8, the concern for liability.
Well, what about the first one he raises?
First one above there. The concern for timely filing?
Yeah, so he says, his final line is, why should anybody file on time when there's no penalty from dealing with you guys and filing the last minute of the last day and they still get
days? Chairman Dyson, 4732060 says that at least 90 days before a license expires, the license entity needs to submit an application. He says, why should we have to bother if the department has an out? The intent of the legislation is that we receive an application, and that we, if we don't do our part and we don't get our work done in time, the entity doesn't suffer and they remain licensed while we get our work done. Now, if that's not what the statute says, and we need to make it say that. That's what the intent is, to say that.
And do your amendments fix that?
We think it still says that. And the lawyers think that what the proposed statute says that that's what's to happen, and disagrees with what Rod said.
Okay. All right. I'm sorry. Go on down to the
page 8, line 2903, concern for liability. I'm going to let Stacy comment in a second. And there is an amendment that we're going to be offering that states that before we would take over management of an institution, that the commissioner would need to be involved, and we'll talk about that in a minute, that it is, that would be an issue of grave concern if we're going to take over management or have a contractor take over management, and that that's a decision that would need commissioner involvement before such an action would be taken. The next one is 32170A, line 16 to 18, dealing with immunity, and I'm going to let Stacy respond to that one. And the proposed statute says that there's no liability for the state or its agents. Stacy?
I'm looking at the letter right here to make sure we're talking about the same thing. Well, the question that ASTA brings up, if I understand this correctly, is they don't agree the state should not be immune from compensating for economic consequences school provider department action was ultimately found to be excessive in the courts. Are we talking about the same thing?
Yes.
Okay. With respect to the immunity language in the bill, which I think you can find at, let me see if I can find it here very quickly. I think it's page 13. Make sure I'm looking at the right bill. If I'm looking at version A, backslash A, it's on page 13. Mm-hmm. When we drafted the bill by taking all of the licensing provisions in the statute, and as mentioned earlier, I think there were 14 or 15 different statutory frameworks for licensure, and we took what we consider to be the best of the best, and made sure, or hopefully made sure, that we caught all of the nuances for each one of, for the different types of licensing. With respect to the immunity provision, the immunity A and B, subparagraph A and B, are cut and paste, if you will, out of the existing statute. They don't expand or they don't diminish current immunities that exist in state law. We didn't want to open up a can of worms, and we didn't want to close a can of worms, if you will. So this is just basically a reiteration of what current law is. The second part of that is that under subparagraph C, that deals with the criminal history check, and that's a little bit of a different rub, and it's not there in current law, I don't believe. And so we wanted to make sure that as folks use these tools, that they were protected from using them as long as they acted appropriately. So with respect to Ashna's comments about the department's actions to be ultimately found to be excessive or in the court, there is no current immunity for the state for any type of action like that, nor is there anything that would preclude somebody from seeking recovery. But I don't think that he's he's inferring that there's an immunity provision that doesn't exist as I can read it. We didn't want to expand the immunities that were there. We just wanted to put them all in one section.
All right. And I appreciate that.
And then the last part, 900, page 15, line 25, has to do with definition of an assisted living home. The part of current statute 4733020 and 005 would still are not being repealed by this act in terms of the further definition of the assisted living home. The what's in this bill on page 15 and 16 is the first part of the definition of assisted living home. We've gone back and thought about it. If you can remember, what he was really talking about is this kind of overlap part between a skilled nursing facility and the highest end of an assisted living facility, and saying there shouldn't be overlap. I think we respectfully disagree and think that the current practice in the state is it's okay that people get to make a choice for themselves and their loved ones as to what type of facility makes best sense, whether it's a Pioneer home as an assisted living home, or whether they want to choose a skilled nursing facility. And then if an assisted living home wants to take on the risk of providing care to a frail elder, then the part of state law that isn't being repealed state that it's a decision between the family, the doctor, and the risk is being assumed by the assisted living home, then we have a responsibility in statute then to evaluate the care that is supposed to be provided to make sure that it is being provided.
Okay. Call your attention to an issue that Senator Green just raised to me over on page 20, lines 22 through 26. Why did you make these changes to existing law?
I'm going to let Virginia answer that question.
Okay. Right over closer to the door.
No, I'm just fine, thank you. Thank you again. The issue here, Stacy can let me know if I'm wrong, but through conforming language throughout the bill that would make it, so instead of a center entity, again, we were trying to be consistent throughout the bill in terms of the language and the definitions that were used. And I think, again, even some of the amendments that you'll see, what we were trying to do is be consistent throughout the bill, so if there was language that had been used in the past that isn't found elsewhere, we were making it conform to standard practice, standard definitions.
Does the federal law preclude a person being in possession of a firearm in a federally on the parking lot of a federally licensed child care center?
Not to my knowledge, Senator. Stacy, you may correct me if I'm wrong there.
Can I ask for clarification of where you are in the bill again? I'm sorry.
Page 20, line 22 to 26.
It's also, Mr. Chairman, on page 19, 24 through 26, 27. Mr. Chairman,
through the chair, if I may.
Yes.
Virginia, Ms. Donkus explained this, but I'll try it another way just to explain. What we were doing is when we went through and made the standalone chapter for licensing provisions, one would be rather surprised, as you can tell by the length of this bill, how many places the previous statutory provisions were cited to, as in like AS 4733, which deals with assisted living homes, or AS 4735, which is foster care, child care facilities, and those sorts of things. So the amendments in sections 3, 2 through probably until you get to the repealers are all conforming edits, just to make sure that when we're talking about licensing functions or licensed entities, we're all talking about the same sort of entity. So that was the reason for those edits on page 19 and 20, that it just now would include those entities who would be licensed if this bill passes under 4732, or if they were previously licensed, because there's some transitional time periods where entities that are currently licensed will maintain their licensure through a transitional period, that we would make sure that everybody was subject to the same rules and regulations. So that's the reason for the license under former 4735, that sort of thing.
Senator Green.
Mr. Chairman, I know I was intimately involved when this legislation was originally drafted and amended, and the language we finally came up with was very, very carefully crafted. And I get the feeling from reading this, if I'm reading it right at all, I may be wrong, that this is an expansion of the prohibition. And you get back to the very simpler, easily imagined situation where someone, as you say, goes into the parking lot of a facility and is certainly fully licensed, you know. And I want to confirm before I would support this, that this represents no expansion. And because this could be any number, and I think this is many, many, many facilities, and that was not the purpose of the original language. And I just want to be sure we haven't really taken that umbrella and gathered up a bunch of entities, many of which are simply not appropriate. Because this was originally started as a conversation about a school, and the conversation about it, and then I think became a center. And so.
Senator Green, through the chair, would it be appropriate that one of the tasks we take out of today is to go test this language and say, what's the universe that would be included if this language were to pass?
And then if we need to narrow it or whatever, then do so appropriately. So we haven't just really, because I can't tell you how many months we spent wordsmithing, and I don't want one sidebar in this bill to come in and undo anything that took years.
Mr. Chairman, this is Stacy again. Senator Green, I understand your concern and I appreciate it, and we'll look at it again, but I hope we were as careful as you're hoping we were, and I think we were, to keep it limited to those types of facilities that were previously listed in the statute. This language, I don't believe, will create an umbrella to include all facilities that are licensed. It's limited to those facilities that were licensed as a child care facility, if they're licensed, if this bill passes under this section, or if they were licensed under the former statute. So it's going to be limited to those child care facilities. So I don't think we've expanded the language, which is what your concern is, but we'll look at it again and make sure we have not.
Thank you.
Thank you. And you and I need to have a sidebar conversation about this, because I, on the surface, am uncomfortable even with what's in existing law.
Absolutely.
If this means any Alaskan stopping to pick up their kid or visit somebody at the hospital on their way to a hunting trip or back is guilty. And any person who's been subject to assault and domestic violence who is protecting themselves, and stops by to pick up a kid or deliver somebody to the hospital that's just been injured, they're guilty. And the last time I got wrapped around the axle on this, if you were carrying mace or a baton, which is not a firearm but is a weapon, and can be, and I was told I had to have a concealed weapon permit for, is guilty. And with the amount of domestic violence we've got in our state, for a woman to not be able, or a man to not be able to carry mace, is real problematic to me. So it's my intention to maybe in the interim here look at fixing all of that, unless Senator Green can convince me that we're butting stumps here.
I'm with you all the way.
Seems contrary to what I think Alaskans want. All right, what else, sir? Let's do. Does anybody else have questions, Senator Elton?
A couple, and I think they're pretty easy ones. I mean, I'm assuming that with the creation of an abuse registry or abuse, that we're going to engender the kinds of actions that could be heard by the Office of Administrative Hearings, whether or not somebody's name should or shouldn't be on the registry. And if that happens, I mean, I would have expected that there would have been a fiscal impact on the Office of Administrative Hearings and that we would see this.
But they're not a state employee.
But it's a state registry.
Stacy, could you hear Senator Elton's question?
I could, and through the chair, Senator Elton. At this point, the due process requirement, if you will, for placement on the civil registry has not been fully kind of settled upon. If a person has been terminated from employment or has had a fraud finding, through some sort of adjudicatory process where they were notified of their violation given the opportunity to appeal, and they failed to appeal, or they appealed it and it was found to be true, then that would solve that sort of due process issue. The ones we need to figure out is for those individuals where there was an adjudicatory process, and we don't know whether or not we could use like a fair hearing process, which is utilized right now for Medicaid and a temporary assistance, which is a little more informal process, or I don't know if we want to get into a full APA, Administrative Procedure Act, hearing with the central hearing panel for these types of situations. So the lack of a fiscal note is basically because we haven't fully developed what that process would be, and we're not sure how we want to pursue that. There may be some costs involved for some sort of administrative procedures, but I don't believe that they're going to be that great.
Second question, Mr. Chair. And it's on page 26, where we provide that a licensed entity has to get a release of information authorization for a criminal history check for any individual who is not a recipient of services for the entity, et cetera. And then you go down to lines 9 and 10, and it says, or volunteer of the entity. And how do we define volunteer of the entity? And I'm thinking, for example, of dog handlers who bring therapy dogs into a facility, or maybe another one would be bikers who collect toys and deliver them to children's wards. I mean, how do you define that, and where is the cutoff point for a volunteer?
Senator Elton, is through the chair. I was just looking quickly, and we don't define volunteer in the statute at present. I think that's why you're asking the question. The larger facilities all have lists of volunteers that have had some kind of training, if it's in a hospital environment with bloodborne pathogens and those kinds of things. So I would assume that we're talking about a volunteer that's on that list. But if you're talking about a small organization like an assisted living home, where somebody would come in with a therapy dog, I would guess they don't have volunteer lists, and I think you raise a good question that is undefined at present.
Good question. All right. So for the folks here, we are not going to get to the vandalism bill today, SB 10. We're going to try to get through this, and any questions that the committee has, Dr. Monstak can work on those before we hear this again, which will be early next week. I do hope to deal with SB 150, the Children's Trust, before, but we're going to close this meeting at 3 because we're going to lose our quorum, and it's just a very busy time of the year, and I apologize for that, but that lets you plan your time. Joel, do you have time constraints that... Do you want to talk to us on this bill or 150?
No, I'm watching with staff. We'll be here for 150. There are other folks who testified for 150.
So you weren't planning on talking to us? All right. Please let me know, because I'm zealous of your time. Hope you have better things to do than this.
I'm not sure.
All right. Please continue, Doc.
We have two sets of amendments, and we had kind of hoped that a CS version would have gotten these incorporated. It would have been easier to talk about. The House and House has Ledge Legal is working on one, but it's not finished yet. So I'm just going to introduce. Most of these are conforming amendments and numbering. So even though they amend, what you have is Amendment 1 and Amendment 2 is thick. I hope you have them.
I don't.
Which is which?
Well,
9:34 a.m. is.
One is 9:32 a.m. That's amendment number one. And this one is primarily due to the fact that the initial draft of the law was interpreting a starting date that won't happen, and so is renumbering everything to allow for a starting date after this bill would pass. Is that an accurate statement, Virginia?
Yes. For the amendment?
Yeah, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I would move amendment number one and then object for explanation.
And that is 24G1, April 405, 934.
Senator Dyson, again, the issue here was when this bill was, when we've been working on this bill for almost 2 years and pulling together the consolidation packages, I know. The whole concept of being able to move forward with the bill and then the further elaboration on the construction of the registry and the background check piece, which was built in and sort of jump-started again with our background check private project bill, the expectation was that this bill would be able to be moved forward with an implementation date for the background check piece, particularly as of July 1 of 2005. Mm-hmm. And again, we realized that was quite ambitious on our part. That again, through the way that the bill is constructed, to change that date throughout all aspects of the bill required 8 pages of conforming language, which is why you'll see that the option for having to go back. So 90%, 99% of what's in that First Amendment speaks to the ability to change the effective date for Section 17, which is the background check piece, to March of 06 or the passage of this bill, whichever comes first. And the March March date was set because, again, by federal law, if we're going to be able to make the time frame that they're helping us establish, that would have to be our drop-dead date.
And then the other 1% of amendment number one is on the last two lines of page one. And if you were look in the definition of the universe that's covered in the bill, which is on page two of the bill, this lists all these different kinds of entities. One of them is ambulatory surgical center, and this amendment would add this phrase B, includes a facility that performs invasive diagnostic and therapeutic services. Let me tell you what that is.
For clarification, shouldn't it be C, because you already have a B?
Adding to B.
We're adding to B, yes. And I'm not entirely persuaded yet that this is the right language. This is my idea, and it has to do with the changing of technology as certain kinds of invasive services leave hospitals and move into standalone facilities. And in many states end up unregulated. For example, you can have a cardiac cath lab that can, in today's world, not be in a hospital that is licensed and evaluated and so on, and could be someplace else and be entirely unlicensed. And I'm suggesting that we have enough flexibility in our definition of ambulatory surgical facilities that if in regulation we would define certain standards that would have to be met in terms of complexity and risk to patients, that the state might in the future decide to license those kinds of technologies. In other states, for example, radiation therapy units have moved out of hospitals and moved into standalone things. Chemotherapy units have moved out of hospitals into standalone entities, and I'm suggesting that we need to have some ability on the state side and not have to come back in statute to change the statute, that if there is sufficient risk to a patient that they would be able, the state would be able to license them.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Yes, Senator Green.
And then what would, I can understand the invasive diagnostic, but what about the therapeutic, what would an example of a therapeutic
It would be a linear accelerator for radiation therapy or chemotherapy for cancer, those kinds of things. But right now in our state, those exist within a hospital, and so they're in a licensed entity. But in other states, they've moved out.
So invasive diagnostic, is that imaging?
It could be imaging, those are two of the words. I'm not sure if they're exactly right yet, but it's if, for example, a cardiac cath lab where you're putting in probes, you're putting in tubes into people.
I understand that one, but where it doesn't put something into the body, except maybe barium or a tracer, is that invasive?
I would think not, and that's why I'm not entirely satisfied with this language, that I don't know. I don't want to get out into doctor's offices. I don't want to get into ordinary x-ray units. But
you want to get into CONs on diagnostic imaging? get the perfect storm going in.
This isn't about CONs. But I think there's some place with licensure that we should be at.
Senator Elton.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I want to use an example. Just had a physical, and my doctor suggested that I'm of the age that I could, I should consider a colonoscopy. I'm not sure I even pronounced that right. I didn't want to listen to him.
Yeah.
When he was talking about it. But he suggested if that's the case, I could go to the hospital, or there is another procedure that he described as kind of a half of a colonoscopy.
Sigmoidoscopy.
Have done at the doctor's office. If you include this language, has his office now become an ambulatory surgical center?
Senator Elton, through the chair, I want the answer to be no, and for that. And so that's why I'm not satisfied that this language is tight enough yet.
I can tell you as a patient, I considered what he was describing fairly invasive.
Yes. Yes. Yes,
Mr. Chair.
So those are the two subjects that are in this amendment.
All right. And all the verbiage on the last page of that?
Is all about this effective date and so on
of
the bill.
All right. So Amendment 2, what's the substance of it?
The substance of Amendment 2...
Do you need to move Amendment 2 before
we... Yeah, please.
I move, Mr. Chair, I'll move Amendment 2.
I'm sorry?
Amendment 1 has been moved and objected to.
All right, so we're going to hold action on Amendment 1 pending modifications and or amendments by the sponsor. Now we've moved on to Amendment 2, and sorry, did you move that?
I move Amendment number 2, Mr. Chair.
I'll object so we can discuss it. Go ahead.
So the pertinent part of Amendment 2 is up at the top of page 2 of the amendment, is a new Section E, and this is what we talked about in response to the Ashna letter, that if the department's going to take over immediate management of a facility, that the commissioner, and we're going to continue management of that entity, that the commissioner would need to be involved. And then everything else that you see around that is renumbering that goes with that. And then the other pertinent part is to correct a drafting error, is down at the bottom of page 3 of the amendment, and it's on page 13 of the bill, that it's up at line 1 of the bill, that would now say AS 4464060 applies to the hearing. The next sentence would disappear because it all applies and the other sentence is not necessary anymore. And then everything else related to that is just renumbering related to that one.
And you're going to have a newly drafted bill that incorporates all this, that we can look at it all in context?
Yes, they're working on it right now.
And what do you expect for next week?
We had expected it maybe today, tomorrow at the latest. It's going to be heard in House Hess on Tuesday, and we've been promised it would be available before it got to House Hess on Tuesday next week.
All right. And I would really in hope that you can find some solution to the issue I raised on what the state law says about where abortions are done and the other issues that were raised here. Thank you.
Okay.
Anything else?
That's where we're at in the bill development.
All right. I really encourage you, committee members, to look at this carefully and see if we can pre-warn the department about any other issues that come up for us before we get to our next hearing so they can be prepared. Thank you, sir. We'll close it here.
Sorry. On both amendments?
Yes.
Margo McCabe, and I serve as chair of the trustees for the Alaska Children's Trust. The Alaska Children's Trust was created by the legislature in 1988 to help fund programs across the state aimed at preventing child abuse and neglect. Under current law, the trust may spend the net income earned by the trust to fund community-based prevention programs. Last year, the trust awarded a total of $217,000 in grants to 16 nonprofit organizations across the state. Current statute limits the size of grants to $50,000 and provides a specific funding formula for funding grants. SB 150 removes the $50,000 cap and calls for the elimination of the funding formula. The Alaska Children's Trust is seeking these changes for a couple of reasons. First, the changes would give trustees the flexibility to set maximum grant awards and funding formulas based on need rather than a predetermined amount set in statute. The intent is not to eliminate caps or funding formulas completely, but rather the trust would outline maximum grant awards and funding formulas with the issuance of each new RFP. More importantly, the changes will allow the trust to be better positioned to receive larger grants from private foundations and charitable trusts. Large grants could then be more easily redistributed to prevention programs around the state. In closing, the rate of child abuse and neglect in this state remains higher in Alaska than anywhere else in the nation. The Alaska Children's Trust remains committed to its mission of improving this situation, helping eliminate child abuse and neglect in this state. It will continue to fund small community-based grants that are truly making a difference, but it would also like the opportunity to consider larger projects that may in fact truly move the needle. Thank you very much for your consideration of this bill.
Margo, my recollection is that the Children's Trust originally saw itself as providing particularly kind of startup and bridging financing to enable organizations that were serving children to get going and establish themselves and establish other funding streams. Is that true?
Yes. I believe that was its initial sort of vision, and I think we still have that vision and that goal of funding small community-based programs, but we also would like to expand our vision and look at how can we really move the needle on this problem, and in some cases, larger grants may be appropriate, and there may be needs.
So, are you going to end up, as a result of this legislation before us, end up being a perennial funding stream for some organizations that can't get alternative funding?
No, I don't believe that we will. I believe that we will continue to set maximum grant awards, and we will continue to implement funding formulas through the RFP process. I think the thought on the board is that programs should be funded in their early stages with declining funding over a period of years, with the hope of self-sustaining those programs. And in fact, we're about to issue a new RFP that requires that our current grantees list how they're going to become self-sustaining after the four-year period.
Is there or will there be a limit, a fine limit on how long an organization can just be relying on you for funding?
Absolutely. With the issuance of each new RFP, we will put that requirement in there.
And what will that be?
Well, last year's legislation proposed 75% of the project's total funding in the first year, in the second year, 50%, and then the third and fourth final year, 25%. I think the board of trustees still likes those numbers, and if it has the flexibility, if this statute was removed, it would implement that language in its RFP.
So, would it be unfair to say that what you're trying to get us to do is remove all the statutory limitations on the length of funding and trust you all's judgment to carry forward the general gist of the legislative intent?
Absolutely.
It would be unfair to say that?
No, it would not be unfair. I'll tell it that. I think that is what we would be doing. Our board is made up of representatives who are very familiar with grant making. We have Diane Kaplan from the Rasmussen Foundation. We have Rami Brooks, who's been involved in the Alaska Children's Trust now for a couple of administrations. And we're all very knowledgeable about grant making and sort of where we're going. And I think the board unanimously supports the legislation as it is drafted today, but also believes in the language that we offered last year and would flow it through in the RFP process.
So you're saying that you like the legislation that was pending last year? It didn't pass, did it?
No, it did not.
You like that, but you don't want it to be in law. You want it to be us to trust you to do that and follow the legislative intention, but you don't want it in statute.
Right. We had some issues moving the bill last year, and the board regrouped, looked at the language, what we were trying to accomplish. And really what we were trying to accomplish is having more flexibility and being able to implement funding formulas that we thought were appropriate. And we can do that through the RFP process if this subsection is removed.
All right. I also understand that what you have with perhaps my complicity, put before us also allows you to receive money that don't go into the principal and can be distributed directly to your recipients, whereas before you're kind of bound to using the earnings off the trust, and this would remove that restriction. Is that correct?
Actually, the language basically just removes the $50,000 cap, and then it removes the funding formula. Our point about being able to go after larger monies as a result of this is our improved ability to turn around and distribute those funds in larger amounts.
I think you just said yes to my question. But indeed, it has been represented to me that you have donors who are interested in donating the money, but they don't want it to go into the principal. They want it to flow through directly to an organization that they particularly feel is valuable. And isn't that a part of your motivation here?
Yes, I'm sorry. I didn't clearly understand the question.
All right.
What would be the purpose of that?
Pass-through money.
I didn't say it was laundering.
Well, pass-through money.
Is it a tax incentive to do that? Why can't they just give it themselves to the individual?
Yeah, Margo, did you hear that?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
Yeah, Cinder Green said, why would a donor want the money to go through the Children's Trust as opposed to going directly to the recipient if they don't want it to go into the principal or trust?
Well, there are a number of larger charitable trusts and private foundations out there that tend to do larger grants, you know, in the $1 to $2 million range. And first of all, it would be hard for an organization like that to find some of the smaller nonprofits that may like some of those monies. And also, from their perspective, it's easier to do a larger grant that then can be distributed to smaller grantees.
Sorry.
Through an organization like the Children's Trust.
So, please, it's not an antagonistic question, but it isn't in order for those donors to be able to get righteous off of a charitable gift, because are all of the recipients of your grants charitable nonprofits that would qualify as a charitable gift under tax law?
They are all nonprofit organizations.
That would qualify as a charitable gift recipient under federal tax law?
You know, Mr. Chairman, this...
Senator Green.
This kind of just flies in the face of the original purpose of the trust, which was to amass donations, money, appropriations, or whatever, and live off that endowment.
Right.
And I think if you want to decrease your effectiveness, you don't put that contribution into the endowment. And if that person doesn't want it to go into an endowment, they need to give it directly to somebody else. I don't think you're the correct vehicle for the deal. And I remember exactly why we had the conversation on the no more than $50,000 to one person, and it phased it out over a few years, because we kept seeing one particular entity in four or five different parts of the state that recurred, and if for its planning purposes. And we thought, well, that's kind of a shame that Project X in Kenai, Ketchikan, Matsu, Fairbanks, and Nome all were getting, Eagle River, were all getting pots of money. And that's when we put the limitation on any single organization. And I haven't seen anything in her conversation that makes me change my mind. And unless there's something else, if I were she, I'd want that money in my in my bank account. And let it be earning the money.
I could see the scenario that I happen to, for whatever reason, have $500,000, and I want to give it to things that the Children's Trust does, and I don't have the time, nor do I care, to go out and analyze what each of these nonprofits are doing. And I would say, here's $500,000, go spread it around to where you think they're doing the best work. And so you use them as sort of your conduit because you don't have the interest to do it. I mean, I could see that scenario also. I think that's part of what they're trying to do.
That's not what the Children's Trust was set up to do. I mean, that changes their whole, the nature of what they are, because they were to be an endowed entity, and I think we went to a great deal of trouble to endow the Children's Trust. And if somebody else wants to add a couple more million to it, that's what it should happen. I don't think they should simply become somebody else's check writer.
May I take a minute to respond to that?
You may. Go ahead, Margo.
Okay. First, with the question of growing our principal, the Alaska Children's Trust is committed to continuing to grow the fund. We've been working with the Friends of the Alaska Children's Trust to add almost $100,000 a year through private fundraising efforts over the last few years. We remain committed to doing that. But there are instances that a couple of you have mentioned in that there are foundations, like the Doris Duke Foundation is one, that may put a caveat that in order for us to receive the money, it can't go into the foundation. It has to be redistributed in the form of grants. For training, education, whatever the case may be, and we just want to be in a position to be able to accept those monies. The intent isn't to spend the principal of the fund or deal with those monies any differently. We want to continue to grow that fund and use the net income to fund small grantees around the state. However, you know, the rate of child abuse and neglect in the state remains unbearably high, and we would like to position ourselves to do anything we can to help move the needle. And we think being able to accept money and distribute it to small organizations around the state helps us do that.
All right, we're not going to act on this today. I'm going to look at the legislation that you say that you all liked last year, but you don't want to have it be in statute. And I think you have some work to do here to convince not only this committee, but the subsequent committees that we should do this. What appears to be a fairly fundamental paradigm shift in the message, mission of the Children's Trust. We will let you know when and if we're going to bring this bill back up under bills previously heard. I don't mean to be discouraging, but it's going to be probably ambitious to get it through both houses this session. But thank you for your testimony. I hope that you all will look at SB 10, the vandalism bill of Senator Geffs, and it's done a remarkable amount of work, I think, that handles most of the objections that come up, and I hope we'll be able to deal with it fairly forthrightly in early next week, and I would commend that to the committee.
Do we have another CS?
I don't have one. I'll ask.
We'll get it.
Okay.
We will get it for you before we hear it with some time. Okay. Any other business to come before us? Well, thank you all. We're adjourned.